Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to Week, the Political Roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California from Monday, April 21st, 2014. Thank you for coming out and joining us today. I'm John Zipper, the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial, and I'm very pleased to be your host for today. As always, we'll try to provide some insight into some of the big issues of the last couple of weeks. Any opinions expressed here are those only of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club, its members, or supporters. Let's meet our panelists for today. I'm going to start in the end there with Dr. Larry Gersten, a political science professor at San Jose State University, a political analyst at NBC Bay Area, and the author of Not So Golden After All, The Rise and Fall of California. He's on Twitter at L. Gersten. Next to him and joining our week-to-week panel for the first time is Martin G. Edwards, the senior editor for community engagement and training at the Bay Area news group Digital First Media. He's also the co-founder of Oakland Voices, and he's on Twitter both as at NewsMojo and Reynolds Post. And next to me is Melissa Griffin Kane, a contributor to KPIX TV, the Mornings with Melissa segment, and to San Francisco Magazine, and she's also an attorney. She's on Twitter at Mel Griffin Kane. So please use the question cards that are spread throughout the room to write down and submit questions. I'll do my best to answer as many of them as we can. And let's get on to our roundtable. For our first topic, I wanted to go back a year because on April 15th, we had a week-to-week program, and we had to begin that by sharing the news that there had been a bombing at the Boston Marathon. And, of course, at that time, we were still trying to figure out, were there casualties? How many casualties? Did we know any details of it? And the following few days were filled with, you all remember this from TV and the news, there were police pursuits, there was lots of media speculation. There were views of this major American city just being locked down. And there was this televised hunt for and the capture or killing of the suspects. It was and remains, I think, a very deeply unsettling time. Today, I'm pleased to note, there was the Boston Marathon today. And at least, as I can report now, at least there has been no violent incidents that we know of. But there are still lots of people, I think, unsettled by violent acts, politically inspired violent acts, and we got some more of them recently where you saw this, I'm sure, in a disturbing attack recently at two Jewish centers in Kansas, outside Kansas City. A former Klansman shot and killed three people. He's an outspoken anti-Semite and an advocate and sometimes organizer of paramilitary groups, and apparently he finally acted upon his beliefs. We also saw, luckily, something that did not become violent, but threatened to, and that was this odd standoff in Nevada in which a rancher named Cliven Bundy, if I'm pronouncing his first name correctly, who had not paid his grazing fees in two decades, he threatened a violent uprising against federal agents who were trying to enforce the law there. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid referred to Bundy and his supporters as, quote, domestic terrorists, unquote. So I want to, with that nice warm opening, I wanted to talk a bit about, is this just kind of a regular undercurrent that we have of threats of violence, political violence in particular I'm focusing on, or is there a growing number of people who maybe feel that this is the way they're supposed to react to the federal government when they don't get things the way they want them to go? I'm going to go to you, Larry, first as our government specialist.
These events in and of themselves, one at a time, don't say a lot. Mm-hmm. Over time, they say a great deal. I think there are two things happening in American society that most of us can't get our arms around. One are the phenomenal demographic changes. We see these even more in California, but it's the case nationally. Latinos are now the second largest group. And we see the percentages of non-Hispanic whites going down, down, down. This is troubling to those who are not willing to deal with these changes. And the other thing is the standard of living. The standard of living in this country is not what it is today. It's not what it was 20 years ago. Forget the Great Recession. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is that the middle class has fallen out. We see this, you know, if you look at the minimum wage today isn't what it was, it's much less. You look at one indicator after another suggests that the middle class is falling apart, whether it's home ownership, whether it's bankruptcies, whether it's, the data goes on and on and on. And people are struggling, you know, to find their way. You find an unsettling economy, you find these demographic changes, and you see large numbers, I'm not going to say a majority, but large numbers of people who lash out because they just don't know what to do. Far be it from me to say this is the right way to do it. But the fact of the matter is, I think what we're seeing here in large part are people who are uncomfortable with their standing, and they don't know how to cope.
You know, and I think what's interesting about that, too, is that, to your point, Larry, is that but yet government officials are calling that terrorism rather than perhaps then looking at what it may really be, which is an unsettled citizenry. I mean, there was the incident that occurred about a year ago in April, the attack on the Metcalf substation, the PG&E substation that occurred, that hadn't been determined to be terrorism, but then a former federal energy regulatory official came out and said, he thought it was the worst attack that had happened in the United States and North America, attack on the power grid. But in fact, there had been no one that claimed any responsibility for it, and they're still looking into it. So the question is, why would people attack a substation, $15 million worth of damage? But I think to your point is that, is it really terrorism, or are people unhappy with the direction that the nation is going?
I mean, I think part of the reason they call it that is because, I mean, this man was fortified with a group of like-minded individuals who also deny the legitimacy of the United States Constitution, who came out and with their own guns. And I think that's an important element of this. I mean, all of these attacks we're talking about involve people with access to extraordinary arsenals of weaponry, and they have histories of antisocial behavior, and yet they've got access to these guns. So this a group of people show up to help this rancher. One of them actually said, "We're gonna, you know, if the government comes, we're gonna put the women out front, so that what will be on TV is government agents shooting women, and that's." Would be helpful for us. That's a strategy that we're going to use. So, I mean, how you negotiate with these people, I don't know. But there does seem to be an element of, at least in this rancher case, there's a social media element of it. I mean, he went, the story got out because it was online, and other like-minded, again, people were able to come together to sort of try and protect him. And so I agree with you that terrorist is probably a little extreme. But when you're talking about a group of armed citizens, you know, refusing to acknowledge the existence or the legitimacy of the federal government, that goes to Professor Gersten's point. They're so disenfranchised and feel so separate from normal society that they're only going to recognize their tribe, right? They only recognize the Nevada state constitution. So that's the only people I'm going to recognize. Or that the shooter at the Jewish Community Center, you know, he's a longtime white supremacist. You know, we're only going to recognize my tribe because that's what I feel close to and comfortable to and feel like acknowledges me and I'm not frightened of, frankly. So, I think guns and social media add to these other elements to create some problems. And over time, it does indicate, I think, something bigger. One at a time, it's harder because you're just sort of dealing with the aftermath.
Well, Newsweek reported that, and yes, there is a Newsweek again, after the Nevada ranch standoff in which the federal government backed off, at least for the moment, that militia, survivalists, and other armed anti-government groups are energized, and they're looking for the next opportunity to have a standoff with the federal government. So it one-offs, but there are undercurrents of continuing movements.
I think for me, things sort of come back to exploring sort of the media's role in how we impact perception. And I think the big challenge right now that we're facing, certainly in the media, is that the media is less and less reflecting the citizens that it's supposed to be reporting on.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that, newsrooms are less diverse than they ever have been. Staffs are smaller than they ever have been. And so the ability to sort of capture the stories that are bubbling up from communities and to be able to sort of capture the challenges that people are facing in a way that sort of speaks to them so that they feel like they're truly being accurately reflected in the stories that are being told about their communities and their lives. Mm-hmm. The challenges in the implosion of the news media to facilitate that we're still trying to settle on how we're going to continue on to be a flourishing press in a time when the economic model has imploded. And so I think the more that the siloing of news also, and sort of that people can sort of only create the narrative that they believe is speaks to them, is also a problem, right? The day of the daily newspaper that everyone read, or the nightly newscast that everyone saw, it sort of spoke to everyone as a country collectively. Those days are gone. We can curate our own news now and create and cultivate and enforce our own perspective. And so I wonder how, to what extent that also contributes to the nature of distrust and discomfort that is permeating our country.
That's a very interesting point, because it's this now 24/7 mentality. There's never a dead time. There's never a time to reflect. Reflect has become a dirty word. Because you got to keep moving. What's the latest development? You know, and of course they spend time talking over the last 2 days' worth, which is no latest development. But the stuff just keeps, you know, percolating. You know, and this is part of the information overload, I think, of the 21st century that we just haven't learned to cope with. You know, everybody's got their cell phone with them nearby. You know, it's like our weapon. You know, and you know, who can get theirs out first? And you know, there's no real opportunity to let the evening go, to digest, to figure things out and take it the next step. And I think that's part of it, the information overload. I should fess up here. I'm finishing a book on disengagement. And so this is flooding me, you know. I eat, sleep, and drink the issue now. This is a very unhappy place. Most Americans are just beside themselves. They're just not happy anymore. There's a sense of loss here. They can't find their way in their jobs. They can't find their way in their social circles. Putnam's Bowling Alone, if you remember that from a dozen years ago, seems like child's play now compared to where we are.
And I think it's primarily economic dislocations you mentioned earlier.
I hate to use the word primarily because there's no one thing, but I think the economic uncertainties in this country now. You know, there's no more job that you have anymore. You know, you go from job to job. And oftentimes it's part-time this and part-time that, and five part-times make almost one full-time, you know. Of course, you don't need your sleep. It's these kinds of things. The young people are out of work in huge percentages. College educations are not.
There are people who are in their 50s who are terrified of losing their job on the knowing they will probably never find another job that pays as well as the one.
One out of four adults under 30 living at home. I shouldn't say so loud because my children may come back. But for a while it was a turnstile in my house. I mean, you know, we got rid of the front door. They're coming in. They're coming out. They're coming in. They're coming out. Who are you? Do I know you? I mean, you know. But all these things together, and you couple that, you know, with the demographic. And the fact that, you know, you're not who I once knew, I don't know who you are, you're not like me, and our schools do nothing to deal with these issues, where they have to deal with them at the bottom. Kindergarten, pre-kindergarten, and they're not. They're ignoring it. You know, let's talk about STEM, science, technology, education, no, engineering and math. Sorry. I feel bad.
Bravo. Yeah. Well, okay. And I think the last point to that is that when we talk about domestic terrorism, I think that I'm more concerned about the acts of terrorism that we're committing against each other in the form of Aurora, Sandy Hook Elementary, the recent stabbing of 22 people by a teenager at that Pennsylvania school. I think there's a time that we need to begin to reflect about our country, our obsession with guns, and our obsession with hurting one another and hurting ourselves. And I think when we sort of look at domestic terrorism, or we get caught up in the sort of NSA things, that spying and what have you, we're not sort of looking inward and sort of assessing what do we need to do as a country, as a people, to come together to find some peace and some connection to one another.
Well, let's move on to our second topic then, which is the mayoral race just across the bay in Oakland. There are something like 15 challengers to incumbent Mayor Gene Kwan. Let me first start ask the audience, by a show of hands, how many of you live in Oakland? Several plus one panelist. And it's primarily, I suspect, a Peninsula and San Francisco audience, but welcome for making the trip. Martin, mm-hmm. 15 people, obviously not all of them are either serious candidates or in touch with reality, but there are some very interesting candidates and there are some strong candidates. Could you start maybe?
Sure, I could talk a little bit about it. You know, Oakland is an interesting place. I love the city. And I think, you know, the candidates that sort of speak to me that have, you know, real some viability there are obviously the incumbent, Mayor Kwan. We also have, of course, Libby Schaff, who's a councilwoman and who was also chief of staff for Ignacio de la Fuente and at one time worked for Jerry Brown. You've got Brian Parker, who was ran a large company and has a real strong background in business and is a port commissioner. And I think that he's raising a lot of money. You, of course, have Joe Tooman, who's a political analyst himself, very smart guy. I think he's also a professor at my alma mater, San Francisco State. Mm-hmm. And then you have Dan Siegel, the civil rights attorney, who's been around for a long time and mixing it up and making trouble in Oakland in his own sort of way. And then you've got Rebecca Kaplan, who hasn't declared but could.
She's
a councilwoman, at-large councilwoman, and she ran back in 2010, but lost, came in second, I think, to Mayor Kwan. And then you've got the rest of the Pointer sisters and that are involved. And I think all of these people are very smart, dedicated professionals. They've been dedicating a long time to making the city of Oakland a better place. And I think that we're seeing a lot of improvement now where people are moving there. The restaurant and art scene are amazing. It's just a beautiful city. Crime is down. So there are a lot of – the narrative about Oakland is changing significantly, and so there's a lot of good things that are happening, but there are a lot of challenges. Of course, you've got a city and a police department under the negotiated settlement agreement, has been under federal watch for many years, has yet to reform. You've got major issues around financial pensions and these sorts of things. So there's a lot of systemic issues financially that the city's facing. And what I was telling my colleagues is that I think Oakland suffers from being a big town, but it's not a huge city, but has big city problems. And that it doesn't necessarily have the kind of political talent or the individuals who would sort of work their way through up, who can step into a room and kind of command it in the way that a sort of big city mayor needs to be able to do to get things done and get everybody moving the same way. Love them or not, and from the voting out there on the board of whether Jerry Brown should be reelected or not, you could argue he was among the most effective mayors because he had obviously been a governor, he had run for president. This was a person who knew how to get things done, and I don't know that any of the individuals on that docket, while they're all smart, they're all talented, they work their tails off, are going to be able to move the sort of political morass in a way, if they're elected, to move that city in the direction that it needs to go.
Why is Mayor Kwan running for re-election? She looks so unhappy. Like, she looks like she hates it so much. Why would she want to do this for an additional 4 years?
Do I really want me to answer that?
Yes, please.
Are we on the record?
Yeah.
I guess we are.
Yeah. Well, sit right there.
Well, let's see. I think Mayor Kwan thinks that she's the best person for the job. And you can take that.
But she just sits there at the debates like this.
You really went out on a limb there, Martin.
Well, I'm learning in my old age.
Well, Rebecca Kaplan seems to be, from the polls that have come out already, and this is, it's very early on, I believe the deadline for committing to running for mayor is August, yeah. Is in August. So we've got plenty of time for her to enter the race. And again, she keeps saying she's not going to run, but She seems to be the only person who wins in the polls, right? So because you've got so many candidates, everybody gets, you know, a certain number of digits, and Jean Kwan still is at the top. Unless you add Rebecca Kaplan, she's the only one who sort of gets a higher percentage. And again, these are all very small percentages, 20%. 4%. Rebecca Kaplan gets anywhere from 20 to 26% and beats Jean Kwan. She's the only one who does so in our imagination right now. Add in, of course, our everyone's least favorite way of voting, ranked choice, and it becomes even more difficult to figure out how anyone's going to beat the incumbent mayor. And again, Rebecca so far has said she's not running, but already, again, we're having forums. There was a big debate the other night at a church, and things are already getting underway, but we're not going to know more about how this is going to shake out until the field is actually defined in August.
Larry, she mentioned your two favorite words, ranked choice.
I'll get to that in just a second. Okay. A couple of things about Rebecca Kaplan are kind of interesting. As the at-large city council person, she carries a certain cachet that the others don't, because she's able to reach out to the entire city. And be found all over the city performing her job. So that gives her, I think, something very special as a candidate. But the other thing is, we should remember enough about people who are mentioned as candidates and what happened, how they're perceived then versus how they're perceived once they are candidates. Mm-hmm. And there's not necessarily a relationship between one who is a potential candidate. Right now, Jeb Bush is becoming more and more of a favorite every day. Mm-hmm. Let's wait and see what happens at that first debate. You know, even though I happen to think he would be a great candidate, you know, he's just not far enough. The point I'm trying to make is that as a non-candidate, she may have a certain stature that she may not be able to move over. As far as ranked choice voting, yeah, fortunately we have a limit on the time here because I could filibuster on this. It to me is an absolute shortcut to democracy. It cheapens democracy. It cheapens the franchise. It cheapens the vote. All this in order to do things quickly. Let's just do it once and be done with. You know, why should we go through this twice? Well, maybe, you know, primaries are our filtering system. You know, they allow us to winnow down from many, 15 or whatever, you know, down to two, and then you take it from there, and there's time for people to figure out who stands out. There are more debates, or this or that, whatever way. But this idea of voting and just reassigning votes depending upon where someone comes out, and then you have someone like Don Parada, who won more votes than anybody else last time. And I'm not here to defend Don Parada or anybody else, but the fact of the matter is, he didn't win the election. If there had been a runoff, we don't know. Everyone speculates. I just think we do ourselves a great disservice, and I find it shameful.
Well, this goes a bit to what Melissa was saying. The Contra Costa Times reported last month that despite a dip in crime in Oakland and the pickup in the economy, Mayor Kwan's approval rating remains dismal. Quote, dissatisfaction with Kwan spanned all age, gender, racial, educational, income, and ideological divides, the poll found. Among ethnic groups, Hispanics gave Kwan the highest marks, even though two-thirds of them were dissatisfied by her performance. Martin, why is she so unpopular? Is this still Occupy Oakland blowback?
I was editor-in-chief of the Oakland Tribune at the time when she was running the first time for mayor. And we didn't endorse her. And we didn't endorse her in large part because we felt as though she didn't necessarily have the ability to build coalitions, to sort of bring folks together, to work together, to move towards something. That she, there was a real sort of bedside manner issue that stuck out to the editorial board at that time. We felt a lot better about Rebecca Kaplan, but also felt that she was very young in her political career, and could she handle the job of being mayor of Oakland? But the reason that Kwan, I think, is so unpopular is her approach. I think she works very hard. Without a doubt, I know that woman works hard. But I think the problem has a lot to do with her approach, how she is in the room, how she deals with individuals. That is certainly the reaction that I've gotten from a lot of folks, and that's certainly the takeaway those on the editorial board had when we were discussing her, whether or not to endorse her.
How big a role does crime play in this election?
I mean, it always plays a role in Oakland because that's one of the key issues that the city still has, the issue of crime and schools, the quality of the educational system and the turnover there. Obviously, the mayor doesn't have anything to do with that. That's an elected board. But crime still is a factor, although it has gone down substantially.
Yep. Yep. We did an Occupy San Francisco forum right here.
That's right.
I moderated it with a number of representatives from Occupy. And Mayor Kwan, and she showed up and was on the panel right next to three other people in a room that was probably, and it was overflow, it was huge, everyone's packed in, and it was probably half like regular Commonwealth Club members and half Occupy folks who had come in. It was free, so you know, it's kind of a motley crew, and we were getting mic checked, and you know, and it was crazy. It went completely nuts. It went off the rails, but she took it. She showed up. She sat here and she gave the answers. And whatever you think of her treatment of the people in Occupy or her leadership, I gave her so many points for being brave enough. I mean, she sits there. She sits in these debates now when they sit and, you know, make jabs at her administration. She at least, you know, she ain't the friendliest lady, but she was very, I gave her a lot of credit for showing up. There was very few politicians who would have confronted such an angry room like she did and really take their questions and let them sit there and say what they wanted to say about her and held her head up and stayed after. I like ran out of the room when it was over. But she stayed and like tried to answer the questions. It was pretty remarkable. So I give her credit for at least enduring her detractors with a lot of spine.
She's got backbone. I mean, she's been in Oakland a long time.
Yeah.
She's been at it a long time. So it's nothing that she hasn't seen before. The question is, can she take the city where it needs to go and do? And the role, I think, of a mayor in a city like Oakland is about getting things done, but it's also about getting people inspired to follow you, to follow your direction, to follow your vision, for people who want to get on board. And Oakland has a lot of pride in the people who live there, so I think they want someone like that. But I just don't think Kwan resonates for them in that way.
That's the mark of a leader,
right?
You know, and the question is, and not everyone can do that.
Right.
You know,
and also you got to think about sort of we've lost a lot of talented people who are at the, you know, we've lost Chief Batts, who was a very talented police administrator. We've lost Deanna Santana now. And Fred Blackwell was going to be city administrator. Oh, no, I'm going to go to San Francisco Foundation. Seems like a softer landing. And there's been myriad of other folks that have been lost. And I think some of that challenge could very well be working with the city's top executive.
Mm-hmm. Other than now Governor Jerry Brown, is this a, I don't know if this is not just a local topic, though we're talking about a mayoral race, but is this a position that people see as a jumping off point to Congress, to the governor's office, or is this a, like when you're mayor of Chicago, that's all you ever want to be, that's what you want to die as? Well, how is the Oakland position seen?
Well, what does it look like? I would absolutely say it's the stepping stone. Without a doubt. I mean, that's the point that I made earlier about the city being large enough to have all of these problems, but not being quite big enough for everyone to want to stay and that this is my end-all, be-all. So, yeah, I would say it absolutely is a place that people go, cut their teeth, realize, well, this is a little more challenging than I would have liked to have done, and then people move on.
Yeah, you know, from the ones I can remember, it's more like stepping down. I mean, Jerry Brown, that's certainly a step down from the other steps he had. Ron Dellums, a step down from the step from where he was.
It was almost like his retirement package. Could be the mayor of Oakland and take a nap and then, you know, come around, leave, go back home, and then go back to D.C. and be a lobbyist.
Kind of like the way he acted in Congress.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, briefly, before we move on, it's still early. The vote doesn't take place until November, but any sense of who you think will be the mayor's office next year?
If I was going to fill in a bracket, I would probably lose. So I just don't know.
No one else wants to take that one up.
Too early.
Okay. Well, let's talk about a different aspect of democracy and lawmaking, and that is online direct democracy of a sort. And my idea for this actually came from a CBS program segment of Melissa's, and that is a Southern California lawmaker recently created a wiki, an online sharing document, if you will, to get citizen input on lawmaking. And they didn't get to actually create direct changes to laws, but they were all able to comment on, suggest changes, and and they were invited to be a part of this. So first of all, can I throw it to you and explain kind of what that was, because I don't think I explained it very well.
No, sure. Yes, you did. It was Assemblyman Gatto from Southern California, which I'm a little disappointed. I would think something like Wiki Law would come from somebody up here closer to tech in the valley, but no. So he creates this this online community. He puts up a piece of probate law, and probate law is just the law of figuring out what to do with your stuff when you die. Okay, so it's this arcane piece of California law. He puts it up, and this is just to test it out. And then he lets people come in and create online profiles and comment on it and suggest changes to this, again, small piece of law. And it was really fascinating because people who – the world is full, and I think we all know this now from the internet. The world is full of nerds who are interested in, like, one little thing. Like, if there's – no matter what it is, you can find somebody who is obsessed with various wrinkles of laws, of memorabilia, of anything. And so what you saw were people, attorneys, mostly coming from places as far as Massachusetts to log in and comment on a different, you know, different way to look at the law and suggest changes. And it was just wonderful. And as someone who does litigate and has had to go to court over literally like the meaning of a comma in a law, it is so refreshing, this idea that you could actually sort of get in there and give some perspective to the law. Because while the folks in Sacramento who draft the laws are very smart and they're good at what they do, there's no way they can anticipate everything that's going to touch on a piece of legislation. And so opening it up, you know, really sort of gets all the sort of ideas, input, and scenarios. Now, mind you, like John said here, it doesn't mean that that's the way the law is now, but it still has to go through committees and go through all the horrible legislative sausage making. But it was, I thought it was such a great way to get that conversation started, and for a way for people to feel engaged and like they've made a contribution and at least suggested something or presented a different scenario. Actually, again, it wasn't just attorneys. There were also some regular people who were like, when my mom died, this is what happened, and were able to give their own testimony. When you have meetings and committee hearings that happen during a weekday, regular people like us don't get a chance to attend them and talk about, you know, again, these sort of arcane pieces of law. So I just thought it was wonderful. He said he's going to be doing one of these each year and encouraged his other elected officials to try this as well. So, you know, there's issues. Obviously, it's not perfect, but I just thought it was such a terrific idea. If anyone should be doing it, it should be California.
Well, here in San Francisco, District 2 Supervisor Mark Farrell is championing this sort of a thing. Using open data to share information and the information the city collects, as well as actually they've set up, they're launching scholarships for a number of students who will actually be going through laws and making notes about them, suggesting changes and things like that. So there was a bit of a Bay Area take on it as well. Is there any downside to this?
Well, there was also, when he was in the legislature, Joe Simidian every year had something called There Ought to Be a Law.
Yeah.
And he invited his constituents to write in, what laws do you think we need? And every year, by golly, he would introduce what his office declared to be the best one, and a number of them became laws. You know, I think these things are great. I mean, you know, anything to get people engaged, anything to get them involved, anything to get them to feel connected is a good thing. Is there a downside? Well, only to the extent that this thing mushrooms and, you know, suddenly you've got 300,000 people weighing in on probate law. You know, I mean, how are you gonna tease out all this stuff? You know, what are we gonna do? But I mean, I think that's what you have to watch out for. And how do you separate, you know, the people who really offer really thoughtful ideas from the nuts out there? I don't know, but I mean, the idea of getting people to think about their role and how they fit in and what they can't be bad. It can't be bad.
Do you think Obamacare would have been different if people had been able to comment on it as it was being formulated?
I think Obama might have weighed in on it. you know, it's hard to know. First of all, we self-select on these things. You know, probate, I'm probably not going to write about probate.
Yeah, you don't want me
to. Someone wants to write me about pre-K education, I'm going to write all over the place. You know, so we self-selected and I don't know. I mean, but I think the idea, what we want to make sure we understand is that because people weigh in on things doesn't mean that there will be something that reflects that collective value, even if there is one. How many times have people wanted to get rid of the First Amendment? Okay, bad idea. People talk too much. Well, do we go ahead and change the law because people weigh in on that? So obviously there has to be a filtering mechanism. That's where a body like the legislature comes in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Martin, is there a downside to this, or is this all upwards?
I don't know. I mean, I guess the only downside could be what kind of special interests might take advantage to get the language that they want. But the fact that there's a filter and it still goes through all the committees in the legislature, I don't see a downside. I think to the panelist's point, if it gets people involved, people feel too disconnected, too unable to influence. All right, I mean, with all the challenges it is to, and the discomfort around campaign finance and how it seems that money buys access, having something like this to where the average person sitting at home in their pajamas with a glass of green tea can say, I want to weigh in on this, and maybe even that some good idea comes out of it. I mean, people are smart. And I think that the more folks are involved in the democratic process, the better.
And you're optimistic to assume that they're drinking green tea.
I am from Berkeley.
It's a G-rated show.
Okay, very good. I think that's a really good point. I think there will be people who will try to game it, who will get a group. I mean, just as you see when you go to a newspaper, there's some political article and then the comments below. If you read enough of them, you get to realize when there are the people who are in there who are, we call them trolls, who are just starting a fight, trying to make political things. And you also start to know there are a lot of these folks who are paid to do this. I think, but something like this is the neat thing about it is, yeah, everyone gets to see that as opposed to all this happening behind closed doors in Washington and Sacramento over expensive food and green tea.
Hmm. Right.
Well, let's talk about some 2014 political challenges. Throughout this year, because it's an election year, each week to week we want to kind of focus on some aspect of the 2014 elections. And this time I just wanted to focus, we'll get to Republicans in another program. This time let's look at some Democrats maybe who are facing some notable challenges or problems. And I wanted to kind of throw out to the panel Mike Honda. I think you know where I'm going. It turns out he can't vote for himself. Larry, what's going on? What does that mean?
He'd like to.
Yeah. He can endorse himself.
As you may know, every 10 years we go through a redistricting process. And by the way, this time, for the first time, we had an independent citizens commission do it. And I think they did a pretty good job. I watched it pretty closely. And a lot of the gerrymandering that we'd seen in the past went away. And with it, the districts were rearranged in a much more efficient, compact manner. And that's not perfectly. There's no way to do it perfectly, but it's pretty well done. Anyway, Honda's district was changed fairly substantially. Half of it is new. Not now new. It was new in 2012. So still relatively new to a guy who's been there for 14 years now. He did not move. When his district was changed, the part that was changed was where he lived. Okay? Try as he did, he just couldn't move his house. He still lives in his house. I think he's a couple of miles, maybe 5 miles, I can't remember. Fairly close, but out of the district. Federal law does not require you to live in your district. If you run for Congress. You are not required. And there are a number of people throughout the country who fit into this profile, perhaps a dozen. There's another one in California, Northern California. So this has become a bit of a campaign issue, certainly for his challenger, Ro Khanna. Basically the thing is, if Honda can't vote for himself, why should you? That's got a nice ring to it. The answer, because I am a political analyst, I go right down the line. The answer is that if the person is doing a good job representing his or her district and their needs, why does it matter where the person lives, assuming it's in the general vicinity? That's certainly what the Honda people will say. Pointing to his record over the last 14 years. But, yeah, it'll be a campaign issue. I don't know that it's going to rise I don't know that it's going to rise to the level of being as important to the voters as it might be to us. Okay?
Yeah, so you talked to them about this, am I right?
Yeah, I interviewed Mike Honda's campaign staff in his office, and they mentioned this, and I was sort of sitting with my little recorder on the desk, and they said this, and I was like, I'm sorry, what did you just say? Oh, no, he doesn't live in the district. And they had a map of the district behind them, and they're like, oh, see, here he is, right over here. And again, he's close. And I was like, how do people know this? Like, I asked the question like six different times because I couldn't believe the nonchalance with which they sort of announced this. And I was like, I feel like this is a big deal. Am I crazy? And maybe it is a big deal to me just because they're in this race. Right, Mike Honda's, one of their arguments against Ro Khanna is that Ro Khanna, who lives in Fremont, has run for Congress now in several different districts. And so the idea is that he just shows up in a district, plops his bag down, and runs for office. But now Ro Khanna's like, at least I live in the district, you know. So it's a very, because geography and sort of running and what district you're choosing to run in has become a bit of an issue here. That's why I was like, wow. But they didn't care. And I think, though, that people who don't like Mike Honda will look at this as another reason not to vote for him. But I don't know if it's going to change, to your point, I don't know if it's going to change anyone's mind about the race. If they're going to go, well, I was going to vote for him, but I see he lives over there, so I'm not. So, you know, it's doubtful it's going to change hearts and minds. But it will probably become more of an issue as we go forward. And because this whole, they're pointing fingers about, like, who's more committed to the district, this is why it's sort of at the crux. But yeah, it is very interesting to me that they shrugged their shoulders and thought it was weird. You do have to live in the state that you represent, FYI. Not the district, but the actual, but as long as you live in the state, that's
so apparently
good.
So I can't vote for Michelle Bachmann.
You cannot, but you could, you know, you represent right LA in. Right now. Okay.
By the way, state law requires you to live in the district where you are running for state office.
For state office.
Rod Wright, the state senator from Southern California, mm-hmm. was recently convicted for living outside of his district and saying that he lived in his district. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, if it's a state office, you can't do it. But it's an anomaly. I think there are so many other issues in that race that I just don't know this is going to – I mean, it will, as you said, I think, you know, Melanie, I mean, if you don't want to vote for him, that's another reason not to vote for him. But I kind of think that that'll be overpowered by some of the bigger questions. Yeah.
What about any effects of the Leland Yee troubles? The state senator from San Francisco who has been suspended?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
His current status? For a number of corruption charges. Is that going to hurt? Are there any Democrats who become vulnerable because of their connections to him or any roles they've played? Or is this just this is a story about Leland Yee and, like Willie Brown says, you know, leave Leland alone?
Yeah, I was shocked at Willie Brown's comments about that.
This was in the San Francisco Chronicle former mayor writes.
I couldn't believe that he wrote that. We probably didn't. But anyway, that's another story. You know, two things. I do believe 2014 gives Republicans an opportunity.
Yeah.
Always does. Because in off-year elections, the turnout is lower, and the folks who turn out less are the poor, are minorities, are students, and these folks are more likely to vote Democratic than not. Okay? So there's a built-in advantage right off the bat for Republicans. Add to that little, you know, stew, if you will, the fact that there are half a dozen races up and down the state mm-hmm. that were extremely close last time around. Democrats won just about all of them. Well, you know, you're really bucking the odds to expect that you're going to win them again, especially with the Yee Calderon Wright stuff going on. And we don't know yet whether, especially the Calderon and Yee things, are going to spill over to other people. Those are two developing stories. I can't wait. Sick mind. But I mean, I think, you know, there may be other names here. Mm-hmm. And with each name that gets brought in under that cloud of suspicion, the more it's going to give people the opportunity to buy what I think is a very compelling Republican argument. You see what happens with one-party rule. You see how they just run over us because they care only about themselves and filling their pockets. That's a great argument, and I think they're gonna make some hay with it.
One of our audience members asks, given that there are only 30% registered Republicans in California, do you think the Democratic Party will ultimately fragment, forming two parties? Any hope of that, or do you think it'll remain? Do you think the Republican Party will rebound, or the Democratic Party, one-party state, will continue?
I think you're going to see. I think you're going to see Republicans make some headway this year. I don't think Democrats are going to wind up controlling the Senate and the Assembly the way they have.
With the margins.
That's correct. I think all you need is one third plus one in either chamber, and suddenly you have phenomenal clout, disproportional, but phenomenal as well. You know, and so I think the Republicans are going to make a rebound in the state this year.
Do you think that someone's going to change? I mean, they may be upset with what's happening with the elected officials and the scandals around, you know, these corruption and other charges, but is that going to make you change your fundamental politics to be a Democrat and all of a sudden vote for a Republican challenger?
No, but just 22% of the state to begin with is declined a state. I don't know. What should I do? You got a dartboard? You know, I mean, you know, they're not as, they don't eat, sleep, and drink politics the way a lot of us in this room do. You know, and, you know, a headline is enough to move them one way or another. And I think when you're talking about such thin margins already, lower turnout, a bit of a scandal. It's a nice recipe there. So I suspect there'll be a bit of a Republican bounce, enough to certainly put the state back into a two-party play, at least in terms of major issues that require two-thirds votes.
Well, there's always talk about, is there going to be a new party? Is there going to be a party of Democrats who aren't really there with the Democratic Party, somewhere in the middle, who aren't as socially conservative as Republicans, but aren't as liberal as the Democratic Party is? You know, who's that? Here's the thing, though. The way it works in terms of getting on ballots and the party infrastructure is important. It does provide a training ground for bringing up talent. It does facilitate funding. It does facilitate overall agendas. It is important, much as people, there's a lot of people that say forget it to both of them. The structure is important, and the notion that a third one could emerge when the two that exist have done a lot of work to make sure that the rules protect them as the two parties is really unlikely. So we like to talk about it. It's a fun sort of thought experiment, but in reality, it's more likely that you'd see the parties realign than an emergence of an actual third party, again, just from a basic structural technical point of getting enough signatures to get on the ballot and all these things that you have to do when you're a political party. So alignment seems a little more realistic. But to your point earlier, there are a number of races that are happening right now, Dem on Dem, where you have what some are calling corporate Democrats versus labor Democrats, and so that's kind of the nomenclature that has emerged. And I was down in L.A. at the Democratic State Convention, and that was there were a lot of fiery speeches about who's a real Democrat, and you know they're taking it seriously, and they're sort of naming it and pointing fingers at each other. And so there really is some discord. It's not crazy to look at this and say maybe it would fracture, but we're going to see, especially with the jungle primary, et cetera, you know, sort of what strand emerges as the dominant one in California. But again, that's more likely than a separate third thing, bull moose party.
Just to add on to that, we have what's called a single district plurality system. Blech, I know, it's awful. But I mean, what it means is at the end of the day in November, whoever wins more than anybody else, not necessarily a majority, more, okay, wins the prize. Wins the seat. And that's responsible for the two-party system, you know, because you aggregate and perhaps aggravate, but you aggregate different forces together to cobble a party so that one side or the other wins. And, you know, that's what happens. That's how the system is built that way, as Molly said.
Okay. Well, our last topic before we get to our news quiz is what I'm calling the spying game. Did anyone see the reports this past week about Russian President Vladimir Putin? He was giving one of his nationally televised chat programs where he was taking questions from Russians. And Edward Snowden, who's not Russian, but he's self-exiled there, if you will, and Snowden is the former NSA contractor who leaked a lot of information about U.S. Domestic surveillance as well as international surveillance. Snowden asked Putin basically about Russian domestic spying and whether it was all kosher. And Putin, of course, said, well, of course, it's, you know, would I do something wrong? But he started off by saying that both he and Snowden were both former spies, so they could talk a common language. Putin, of course, had been a KGB agent in East Germany during the Cold War. I want to move from that to a fight that Dianne Feinstein, the U.S. Senator from California, is having. I believe it was last month when she came out in a very strong Senate floor speech, accused the CIA of improperly, what was that? They removed files or something from some computers that her Intelligence Committee was using as part of their investigation into something. Well, that came out as a big story of, oh, here's Dianne Feinstein, she's picking this fight, this is interesting, and it died down. Well, then the story got quite a bit more interesting, I think, more recently when she and some other members of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee are trying to get the White House to declassify a report on CIA activities. And for those of us, okay, I was in grade school, those of you who remember the Church Committee back in the 1970s, this was the congressional committee that unveiled a lot of questionable activities and illegal activities of the U.S. intelligence agencies. There are some echoes of this, and I'm kind of wondering, and I'm going to throw this to the panel, how much of a fight in her do you think Dianne Feinstein has? Is this a very technical issue that she's going after, you know, how her committee is treated, or could this become a more wide-ranging look at what is an incredibly well-funded, very politically powerful intelligence community? Martin?
Yeah, well, you know, this is interesting. I was just on a panel last week with Seth Rosenfeld, who just came out with his book, Subversives, the FBI War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power, and also Lowell Bergman, who we all know his illustrious journalism career. And a lot of what they were talking about was how the FBI at the time was infiltrating a lot of these student groups and sort of the impact that that had. And they also, in Betty Metzger's book, also that you should perhaps check out, which is The Burglary, which was the Neville-told story about a history-changing break-in at the FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, by a group of unlikely activists, just ordinary folks. And that break-in had led to revelations about J. Edgar Hoover's FBI COINTELPRO program that was going on at the time, the efforts to undermine the free speech movement, the civil rights movement. And so, you know, when I sort of look at now, you know, the issues, and also the other thing that really freaked me out then, being a newspaper guy, was that apparently the level to which newspapers at the time were sort of in cahoots, allowing the narrative of the intelligence community to sort of just be spun. A colleague of mine, Larry Wilson, who works in the LA Daily News Group, he and I were just aghast at the fact that, what? Newspaper people were actually spinning the tale of the intelligence community. I mean, I've been at the paper for 17 years, and we wouldn't even let the publisher tell us what we're supposed to write, let alone an FBI agent. And so this stuff was really happening. And so for me, looking at sort of the Feinstein thing, and I think this is a very opaque and hard sort of thing to look at, you know, there was a quote, Darren Samuelson from Politico said that this is the most serious feud since the intelligence committees were established, said former National Security Council staffer and senior fellow at the Stanford U. But, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if that's the case. I think that for a great degree, because the NSA scandals have come out, because people are outraged by this, I think to a certain extent, Dianne Feinstein, though I believe that she is upset, I think politicians have to be viewed as taking a strong stand against the intelligence community right now. I think if they didn't do that, I think that to a certain extent, they probably wouldn't be representing the perspectives of their constituents. But I don't know that it's necessarily having any effect on what's actually happening on the ground every day in the intelligence community and the work that they have to do. And I think I would also say this, is that to a certain extent, I'm much more heartened now with the level of oversight that I think the intelligence communities are going to get through journalists, through media organizations that now are not in cahoots with, well, certainly to the same degree that they may have been back then. I mean, I think that now news organizations, this is what they get up for. When a story like this breaks, these are big, big headlines, big issues, things that people are concerned about in the Washington Post, the Reuters, the APs of the world. They may be diminished, but they're still on the case. So I think that there's still going to be a lot of coverage of this. But I think for me, the bigger concern I have around the intelligence community issue isn't about the FBI or the CIA necessarily. It's the little intelligence agencies we have across the 9 counties of the Bay Area, more than 100 cities, 100 police departments, and the ability for news organizations to hold those entities accountable, which I would argue have more ability to impact our liberty and freedom every day than, say, the NSA that's going to capture my email and see the barbecue recipe that I sent to my cousin. I'm more concerned about our ability. Like, we're covering crime, but we're not covering police departments. We're covering homicide cases, but we're not covering homicide divisions. So, and think about the number of agencies that are lacking the level of oversight necessary because of the lack of journalists that are present in our current journalistic ecosystem. That's more of a concern for me.
Is it also, it's not, even if, had they the people to cover that, do you think it's also a more uncomfortable thing for them to cover? It's one thing to cover an agency in Washington and a large political thing that everyone understands. Another thing to cover the police officer you might know lives down the street and, you know,
well, no, none of the police officers live in Oakland, so we don't have to worry about that. They all live in Danville and San Ramon. But I think it's just more of a challenge. No, I think journalists inherently want to cover those issues, but I think the issue is personnel and capacity.
I think there are a couple of things here. One, you're absolutely right about the local. I mean, that's where things happen all the time, and we don't know what's happened. Stuff being rushed. Lourdes Cordell is the, I don't remember her title, but she's sort of like the police auditor. That's what she's called. Okay. In Santa Fe. Former judge, you know, bright as can be. And, you know, she has taken San Jose police to task just recently, and I mean, in a really tough way. And I think we need more of those types of offices locally. And you mentioned something early on that I resisted from commenting on, but now I have to. And you know, you talk about journalists. You know, one of the biggest problems we have is that there aren't enough anymore.
Right.
That the newspapers, particularly, which we've relied on to do these things, you know, have cut their staffs to next to nothing. I got called by a journalist the other day about the Yee thing.
About the what?
Yee.
The Yee thing.
Oh,
Yee.
Yee
thing.
Yee, yeah.
Oh God, I should put that differently. The charges regarding Leland Yee. And, you know, he asked me to make a kind, talk to him for an hour or so. Call me back. You need another quote. What kind of quote do you need? And I haven't given you already. Well, I need you to say that this is, you know, the worst thing you've ever seen on this type of thing.
Well, who's he writing for, Chronicle?
I'm not going to say. I'm not going to say because that's a no win. But I am going to say that I say, well, I've seen a lot of scandals in my day. You know, shrimp scam among them, you know, pretty bad. You know, and I said, what data do you have? Do you have data from the other journalists, or the other members of the legislature who have taken more money for things than he has, or has he taken more? Can you point me to that data so I can make a comparative comment? No, we don't have time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't have time to give you a comment because I can't comment just because I think it's something.
Right.
You know, and I think that's a problem. That wasn't his fault. But, I mean, you know, we just don't support these things like we need to investigative journalism. And so you rely on, oddly enough, the alternative sources, you know, which do a good job sometimes but can be very messy. To me, I agree. I think these issues are so close to home and really important.
Okay. I just really quickly, though.
Sure.
So Dianne Feinstein, of course, was called emotional, her response to the CIA refusing to turn over the report. And I just want to point out her biography – which is quite good, is called Never Let Them See You Cry. And basically the entire book is about how she is very steely and very emotionally controlled, and it all has to do with her dad, and just read the book. But but she's really tenacious. She's like a dog with a bone. I think that, you know, she goes after this, she's going to get it. And not to be too cynical, but there is, of course, a political element to this, as you point out. Who's the next candidate who may be declaring, who may actually give Hillary Clinton a run for her money? Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush, to the extent that we can compare him and tie him to the other Bush administration, and to the extent we have a report that shows all the really, really horrible, horrible things that happened during W's tenure in office, you know, it sort of, it does taint the water. And, you know, again, with Jeb Bush now in this point of trying to make a decision, you know, it can't hurt. I'm not saying this is why, but I'm saying it can't hurt to sort of, you know, further sully, not unwarranted, the George W. Bush administration right around the time when Jeb is trying to make a decision whether to jump in, to what extent he's going to be compared to and tied to his brother's administration. So there's that element as well. Again, I don't think it's the reason, but I think it certainly helps. And there's a lot, you know, there's certainly she does affirmatively believe this, but there's also, you know, there's theater involved as well.
You're not making the accusation, but you're mentioning it.
I'm just saying.
Okay. Well, let me toss in a few audience comments before we go to the news quiz. One person writes, many, going back to our first topic tonight, today, about political violence, many years ago Malcolm X said that violence is as American as apple pie. Nothing has changed except that we have a larger population and better communication. Here's a question, and maybe just briefly, if folks want to chime in. What's the probability that California will be split up into two or more states? Larry?
Somewhere between zero and none.
So 50%?
There have been,
I'm bad at math.
There have been 200 efforts,
yeah,
since California became a state, including this most recent one, of course, six different states, and that's not going to happen.
And the problem is the U.S. Congress would have to vote to approve, even assuming we all wanted it. They would have to vote to allocate additional senators, which is the really big question, senators to the state, and it just, the chances of that happening are absolutely zero. Again, assuming we even wanted it. There are separatist movements in places like Colorado and other places where they're constantly trying to break off and form new republics. If we were to do this, and Congress were to allow it, I mean, it would just, it would be the beginning of a lot of problems in a lot of other states, and that's why I think there's no chance that even a referendum would result in a positive reception in Washington, D.C.
If a part of California wanted to secede, would Russia invade it then and take it over? Martin, do you agree with those two, or do you have
Oh, yeah, I think it would be, you'd be opening a Pandora's box, it'd be bad.
Okay. Well, let's go on to our news quiz, and I'm going to do it a bit Donahue style.
Wait out to the studio audience.
I'm going to actually go amongst the people. Okay, so I'm going to ask a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. We'll give you a chance to give us the answer, and then you'll win a valuable small chocolate prize. So, okay. The first question is, who refused to go along with an agreement designed to reduce tensions in Ukraine? There were a number of parties involved. Let me go right there in the back.
Shall we say, ambiguous pro-Russian groups in eastern Ukraine.
You are correct. And did you see the news stories today where they've now identified a number of those folks as actual Russian security forces people?
The last day of the anti-government, when the pro-Russian president was in power, there were almost 100 people shot by snipers, apparently at random, including pro-Russian people, anti-Russian people who were the demonstrators, yeah, and bystanders. And they may or may not be the same people, but has anybody ever, I know The Guardian went after this, but has anybody figured out who they were yet?
I do not know. I know they've gone after, the way they kind of found out the connections between some of these pro-Soviet folks and, pro-Russian folks and actual Russian intelligence agencies is by going into the photographs, and they were able to match them with other photographs where they were in obviously Russian military situations. Yeah, yeah. Okay, the next question. Kathleen Sebelius is resigning as Secretary of Health and Human Services. What job did she have before she became Cabinet Secretary? You all do remember Donnie here, don't you? That's right, the governor of Kansas. There you go. Oops, I'm sorry. Let me just throw this at random people. Thank you.
Sorry.
This was just announced, what will most smartphones have beginning in July 2015? Sorry, can you say that?
Cut-off switch.
That's right, a kill switch, so that if it's stolen, that you can render it useless right away. Okay, Charles Cooper. Charles Cooper is the lawyer who argued before the U.S. Supreme Court in defense of California's ban on gay marriage. He now says his views on the matter have evolved. Why?
Mm-hmm. His daughter has come out as a lesbian.
That's right, and he's helping her plan her marriage, her wedding.
The Lord works in mysterious ways.
Okay, an Islamic girls' seminary in Islamabad, Pakistan, has named its library after whom? Are you first?
Malala Yousafzai?
No, I'm sorry.
That's what I get.
Would be a good one. That would be a good sign.
Osama bin Laden.
Osama bin Laden, yes.
Oh.
Well, that's where you can put all the books you want to burn. Okay, a couple more here. In his Easter homily, Pope Francis urged people to pray for peace where?
Serbia and Syria.
No, I'm sorry. That's continuing prayer. Does anyone know this? That's okay. It was Ukraine. Okay. Jason Carter, he's the grandson of former President Jimmy Carter, and he's the Democratic candidate for the governorship of Georgia, also a position Jimmy Carter used to have. Jason Carter said today that if he became governor, he would not stop what practice in the state? Does anyone see the story? I'll give you a hint. It involves license plates.
It wouldn't allow the prisons to make them.
No, that was not it. Anyone want to guess? He would not stop the practice of allowing people to get the Confederate battle flag on it. Yeah, Mamma Mia. Okay, here's one. Commentators on the right, and even some on the left, have been all aflutter about the political implications of what news from the Clintons?
Chelsea's pregnancy.
That's right. Chelsea Clinton has announced she is pregnant.
Thank
you. Okay, one more, folks. Frazier Glenn Cross, also known as Frazier Glenn Miller Jr., he was the guy who was arrested for killing three people at Jewish centers in Kansas. He's a former Klansman who also founded another racist organization. Does anyone know the name of that organization? It's not a nice name, so I really shouldn't. Anyone want to guess? No? It was the White Patriot Party. Let's end with one. Okay. What city's police department said it would stop spying on Muslims?
New York.
You are correct. So domestic spying actually took one step back this week. It was New York City. They've had a very high profile and very controversial program where they spied on Muslims in the area. I want to thank our panel, Dr. Larry Gersten, Martin Reynolds, and Melissa Griffin-King. Thanks all of you for coming. Have a great week.
Thank you.